The case will be taken under advisement, and the court would like to thank both counsel today for really outstanding oral arguments. Both of you were a great help to us. And the case will be taken under advisement. Our next case this morning is number 042671, Mark Cody against against Taft Harris and Dontron Incorporated. Mr. Hollander.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, we are here today because the district court respectfully erred in two respects. The district court erred in granting summary judgment to the defendants in this case by finding the subject inside radio article as inadmissible hearsay, and further erred by dismissing two of the counts in Mr. Cody's third amended complaint. I think a few key facts are appropriate for Your Honor's consideration. First, as Your Honors are well aware, Mr. Cody was the general sales manager for WPWX, a radio station owned by the defendants. Mr. Cody determined that it was crucial for the radio station to have a web presence. He took it upon himself to negotiate with a Mr. William Slombarski, the cyber squatter in this case. Management refused to support Mr. Cody in the purchase of the domain name. Subsequent to that time, Mr. Slombarski posted the offensive image on the website, which the defendant Taft Harris saw in January of 2002 at a sales meeting. At that point, the defendant Harris proclaimed, "This has got to be Mark Cody." Mark Cody was behind this in the presence of a number of account executives. Subsequently,
he proclaimed this where?
I'm sorry?
Where did he say this?
He said at a sales meeting in January 2002 at the radio station.
And this is brought out in depositions?
Oh, yes. Subsequent to that time, Inside Radio ran an article on January 11, 2002, which is the subject of this lawsuit. Inside Radio published an earlier article on October 8, 2001, publishing an earlier falsehood that Mr. Cody was falsely, I'm sorry, that he was escorted from the building. The January 11, 2002 article had the following defamatory statement made by the defendant Harris, referring to the activities of Mr. Slombarski and the posting on the website. Mr. Harris remarked, "It's got to be a competitor or a particular ex-employee." The other defamatory statement was that Mr. Cody attempted to extort $25,000 from the radio station. Now, in this case, the district court respectfully erred in granting summary judgment to the defendant by finding that the article was inadmissible hearsay. Now, this article was admissible under the residual exception to the hearsay rule 807. Now, to be admissible, the plaintiff or proponent must show several things. One, that the evidence has circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. The statement is offered for material fact. The statement is more probative on the point than other evidence that which is available. And the general purposes of the evidence and admission of the evidence will be served. Now, in this case, the district court found that the Inside Radio article lacked circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. In this respect, the district court erred. While we are cognizant that the residual exception is to be used in exceptional circumstances, this is one of those circumstances. In this case, we have extensive corroboration that this article is reliable and is trustworthy. The corroboration is as follows. First, the statements at the January 2002 sales meeting, where Mr. Harris said, "I know this has got to be Mark Cody. Mark Cody's behind it." Later, "We have evidence against Mark Cody." Clearly, that shows that these statements made several days later in the Inside Radio article are trustworthy. The defendant Harris told another account executive, Elizabeth Pedraza, that he blamed Mark Cody for the article. Mr. Harris told a security guard who stood guard over Mr. Cody's office that he was violent. Further, in an earlier Inside Radio article in August 2001, Mr. Harris acknowledged that he was accurately quoted in that article. Further, and probably some of the most important evidence in this case, the defendant Harris admitted speaking with Mr. Caliano, the publisher of the article, and admitted as to making several key statements in the article. He admitted telling Mr. Del Cagliano that he knew that the website was owned by Mr. Slombarski. He admitted in his deposition that they discussed Mark Cody's involvement in the development of the website, or attempting to get the domain name. He admitted discussing a $25,000 figure. And he also admitted that Crawford Broadcasting Company was going to take certain legal action. After the article was published, the defendant, Harris, did not seek to have a retraction of the article, though he had substantial experience dealing with the media. In addition to that extensive corroboration, what we have here, Your Honors, is the following. We have a number of letters, separate apart from this Inside Radio article, which the defendant, Harris, wrote to Don Crawford, president of defendant. In those articles, or letters, and memos, he said that he was concerned that Mr. Cody would be removing files from the radio station. He also said that Mr. Cody might physically attack him and that he was capable of sabotage. Clearly, we have the defendant Harris's intent, motive, and modus operandi. Clearly, this is very extensive corroboration as to the Inside Radio articles, as opposed to other cases which have dealt with newspaper articles and courts which have held those articles to be inadmissible hearsay. We have very, very extensive corroboration, not only as to the specific statements contained in that article, but in whole corroboration. Further, independent of 807, this article is admissible as a present assessment impression, and we believe that the court respectfully erred under the Ruiz analysis. Under Ruiz, the statement must be made without calculated narration, the speaker must have personally observed the event, and the statement must be made contemporaneously with the event or immediately thereafter. Now, again, these statements or these observations made by the defendant Harris were in early January of 2002. The article ran a mere few days later. Clearly, the evidence in this case is there's a short temporal nexus between the defendant Harris's viewing of the website, his statements, and then his later statements to Inside Radio. Based on that, we think that not only under the residual exception, but also these statements are admissible as a present sense impression. Further, we believe the district court erred in dismissing counts 1 and 2 of the third amended complaint. These were the per se comments which I just mentioned that were made at the January 2002 sales meeting. In this case, the district court held that these statements were not actionable because they did not affect or touch upon Mr. Cody's ability to perform his job. But a key statement in this case, key evidence in this case, is Mr. Cody was the sole individual who was responsible for trying to develop a website, acquire the domain name, and dealing with Mr. Slombarski. In this case, clearly, any statement that Mr. Cody was behind it, that he attempted to publish these images on the website, clearly showed that it touched upon his ability to discharge his job as a general sales manager. We believe that this evidence, the per se categories which would involve would be the commission of a criminal offense, the inability to perform his job, and the fact that these statements impugned his profession as a whole. Unless the panel has any questions.
Did you argue the criminal offense aspect before the district court?
We did not. We did not. Our subsequent research led us to believe that clearly not only did it touch upon the professional categories, but also the fact that this violated the Illinois Obscenity Act and that it was actionable under that basis as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollander. We'll hear now from Mr. Peel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Jeffrey Peel. I represent both defendant appellees in this matter. I represented both of them at the district court level as well. There's a lot of material to cover. I'd like to start with the summary judgment decision. As you know, Judge Aspin decided that the Inside Radio article was inadmissible hearsay. The standard of review is an abuse of discretion standard. It's a very steep standard. Mr. Cody must show that Judge Aspin committed clear and prejudicial error and that no reasonable person could agree with his finding. And I would submit to you that through the written and oral arguments, he is not satisfied.
Does that mean no reasonable person could agree with his finding? Does that mean if we disagree with the judge, we've got to commit him? I mean, that's such a hyperbole.
Well, it's taken from case law.
I know it's yap yap from the case law. You know, this law clerk soundbite stuff. That can, but does it really give us much help?
Even if we discard that part of it, you just have to look at clear and prejudicial error here, and I don't believe that standard has been met. We'll first look at the present sense impression argument. In order to establish that exception applies, you need to take a look at the declarant and the statement. And in this situation, the article, the Inside Radio article, is the hearsay statement, and the declarant there is the author. So in order to establish that this exception applies, Mr. Cody must show that the author wrote this article or made the hearsay statement while he is observing the event at the time or immediately thereafter. There's absolutely no evidence in the record, one, as to who the author is. There's evidence that Mr. Del Coliano spoke with Mr. Harris, but there's no evidence who wrote the article. What did Mr. Del Coliano do after the telephone call? Did he pass his notes on to someone else? So there's no evidence that the author made the declaration at or about the time Mr. Del Coliano spoke with Mr. Harris. Second, there is absolutely no evidence as to the timing between Mr. Harris speaking to Mr. Del Coliano and the writing of the article, the editing of the article. There's absolutely nothing in the record which would show how much time had lapsed. And Mr. Hollander just suggested that a statement may have been made within a couple of days. Even if the statement was made the day before, there are cases in this circuit and other circuits which suggest that even a time lapse as short as 1 hour is too much time to pass for the present sense impression exception to apply. Lastly, he must show that the statement is made without calculated narration. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that the statement was made without calculated narration, but there is evidence which would suggest that there might be calculated narration. Mr. Del Coliano, during this conversation with Mr. Harris, told him that he was currently embroiled in litigation with Clear Channel, which is a competitor of WPWX, and he recommended to Mr. Harris, his own lawyer, if he was to pursue legal action against the person who posted the material. Mr. Del Coliano raised the name of Clear Channel during that conversation. Clear Channel is identified in the article the next day, and it is suggested in the article by the author that one of the perpetrators may be a competitor of WPWX, which is Clear Channel. So that would support a finding that there was calculated narration. In any event, there is absolutely no evidence that Judge Aspin committed clear and prejudicial error in excluding this article under the present sense impression. Similarly, under the residual exception, the case law makes it very clear that this exception should be applied only in very rare and exceptional circumstances, and this is not one of those circumstances. As Mr. Hollander admits, he does not cite a single case where a newspaper article or newsletter article has been admitted under this exception. To apply the exception here, again, we need to look at the article. We need to look at the declarant, and that is the author of the article. There's no evidence as to the trustworthiness of the article. If you look at the evidence in the record, again, there is nothing about who wrote the article, when they wrote the article, what the process was from discussion with Mr. Harris until the time it got written down, whether it was edited, reviewed by anyone else. So there is evidence in the record that Mr. Harris expressly denies making the statement that's reported in the article. There is no contradictory evidence anywhere in the record. Not a single person testified that they heard Mr. Harris make that statement to Mr. Del Coliano or anyone else at Inside Radio. There is no witness who stepped forward to say that Mr. Harris was accurately or inaccurately quoted in that article. And most importantly, the person to whom Mr. Harris spoke, Mr. Del Coliano, did not testify in this matter. He's alive. He's available. He did not testify. He did not give an affidavit, and he did not give a declaration. So there is no evidence in the record, contrary to Mr. Harris's statement, that he did not make the statements reported in the Inside Radio article. Moreover, the argument that Mr. Harris, that there's corroborating evidence regarding what Mr. Harris may have said or done, that does not go to whether or not the article itself is trustworthy or the reporting or perception of the author or the declarant is trustworthy. Again, there is evidence in the record to the contrary. There's evidence that the article is not trustworthy. Mr. Harris, again, denies making the statement. There's evidence in the record by Mr. Cody's own deposition that Inside Radio had previously published material without permission to publish material. There's evidence in the record that Inside Radio had previously published material which was inaccurate, an inaccurate report. And as I stated before, there's evidence of a calculated narration here where Mr. Del Colliano very well may have had a motive to write what he wrote because of his ongoing litigation with Clear Channel, which is the main competitor for WPWX. Now, with respect to the corroborating evidence that Mr. Hollander identifies, again, that does not go to the declarant. It's going to Mr. Harris. But even having said that, the record does not support the claims that Mr. Hollander is making. Harris does admit that he spoke to Mr. Del Colliano, but he denies much of what is alleged by Mr. Cody and what is alleged to have been or what is reported in the Inside Radio article. He was asked expressly, do you believe that Mark Cody was responsible for this website? And he said, I have no idea. He was asked expressly, do you believe that Clear Channel is responsible for this posting? And he said, I have no idea. He said he did acknowledge that he knows that Mr. Slombarski had registered the website. He did not admit as to any dollar amount that Mr. Slombarski had asked for, but he did say that they would pursue some legal action. But he does not admit what is written in the Inside Radio article. And again, there is no witness to ever who have testified that they heard Mr. Harris make the statements reported in this article. With respect to some of the testimony Mr. Hollander identified as to other witnesses, he identified Ms. Pedraza. Much of the argument made by Mr. Cody on appeal is citing other inadmissible hearsay. He does not cite the testimony of any witness who said they heard Mr. Harris accuse Mr. Cody of trying to extort the radio station. The testimony regarding Ms. Pedraza or Ms. Myers or the security guard does not come from those individuals. It comes from Mr. Cody himself. Mr. Cody testified that he heard from another person that Mr. Harris said something. The issue as to what this person in the middle, the middleman, said is hearsay. He's offering it to prove the truth of the matter asserted, and it's hearsay, so there's no evidence to support those claims. It is true that there are memos written by Mr. Harris to his boss, the owner of the radio station, regarding Mr. Cody, but those articles are written 3 months before or 4 months after the article. They do not bear on the subject of the article. They don't talk about the article. Have absolutely no relevance whatsoever to the issue here. On top of that, they are communications between a manager and his supervisor, the qualifiably privileged, and there's basis in the record to show that those letters are justified and supported by Mr. Harris's very real concerns about Mr. Cody. There is undisputed evidence in the record that Mr. Cody was previously terminated by his prior employer after being disciplined 3 times for altercations or disagreements with subordinate employees, including physical touchings. Mr. Cody admitted at his deposition that in an angry dispute, he threw a bottle of the contents of a bottle of juice on a female sales representative. There is undisputed evidence that Mr. Cody came into the workplace during a week when he was not scheduled to be there, and he removed from the workplace a computer and speakers and other property of the station. So the argument that there's corroborating evidence, I submit to you that if you look at the record and look at what is actually admissible evidence, there is no corroboration to support the admission of this article. This is not the rare and exceptional case where this should be admitted. Moreover, he has not shown that this is the most probative evidence. There are two witnesses to the conversation that's reported Inside Radio. Those are Mr. Harris and Mr. Del Colliano. Mr. Harris has testified. He's denied making these statements. Mr. Del Colliano, again, is alive and available and was not offered to testify in this case. The argument that Mr. Del Colliano was not available is only put forward by Mr. Hollander in his own affidavit, which, again, is hearsay and does not show that Mr. Del Colliano was unavailable. What it does show is Mr. Del Colliano is alive, that he knows where to find him because he did speak to him, but it doesn't show that Mr. Del Colliano could not come and testify about this article. And lastly, the interest of justice and the evidentiary rules would not be best served by admission of this article because there's clearly no circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. There is more probative evidence. And finally, the article on its face is vague and ambiguous as to what it means. It doesn't identify Mr. Cody by name. It says it's possibly one particular former employee. It could be a competitor. Mr. Slombarski is mentioned time and again in this article. And so the teachings of this court in the Eisenstadt case is such that admission of the article where it's not clear on its face what it means and the author or purported author is available, it would be abuse of discretion to admit that article. So I would submit that the district court did not abuse its discretion in keeping out this article. Now, turning quickly to the motion to dismiss, I'll start with the question as to whether or not the obscenity argument was raised before. Mr. Hollander has admitted it was not raised before. Four complaints were filed. Not a single complaint made any reference to the first category of per se defamation. Mr. Cody never alleged that the statement made by Harris allegedly to his staff imputed the commission of a crime. This came up for the very first time on appeal, and it is waived. There's not even a suggestion in any of the complaints that Mr. Harris accused Mr. Cody of illegal behavior, criminal behavior, or even any wrongful behavior. What he is purported to have said is that Mr. Cody was responsible for the posting of this material. And so we believe that that argument is waived. Now, looking at the defamation per se claims that were raised, they were raised under both the third and fourth categories of defamation per se, and those are the categories in which a statement is said to impugn the individual's ability to perform or want of integrity in the discharge of duties of their office or employment, or to prejudice the employee in their trade or profession, and also by impugning their ability to perform. Mr. Cody was the general sales manager at the radio station. He was responsible for sales, for management, and for management of sales. And there is nothing tying that you could find in the statement by Mr. Harris to his staff, which in any way criticized Mr. Cody's ability to sell, manage, or manage sales. There's no criticism of his performance at WPWX or at any other employer identified in this case. There's simply no attack on Mr. Cody's ability to perform or his want of integrity in performance of his job. Now, Mr. Hollander raises the argument that one of the facts here is that he was responsible, Mr. Cody was responsible for negotiating with Mr. Slombarski for the website. If you look at the statement again, there's no criticism of Mr. Cody's handling of that matter. It doesn't criticize Mr. Cody's negotiation ability or his dealings with Mr. Slombarski. It's silent on that subject. And to the final point that Mr. Hollander makes, that one of Mr. Cody's responsibilities was for creation of a website, there is no allegation that Mr. Cody ever was responsible for putting content on a website. The website didn't exist before he was terminated from employment. Again, the statement does not go to his responsibility, his function, his performance in his job at WPWX or anywhere else, and it does not prejudice him in his profession or his trade. It cannot be said that this statement on its face is so obviously and naturally damaging to him that no proof of damages is required. It's saying that he committed, at most it says he's committed this one act of wrongdoing. It does not go to a fundamental inability to perform in his field. It does not go to a general incompetence in this field. It simply does not impugn his ability to perform or prejudice him in his profession. Now, finally, there is the tortious interference arguments. They were not raised by Mr. Hollander on the opening argument, but I would submit to you again that the district court correctly ruled there. Mr. Cody, from the beginning, has asserted and held tight onto his claim that this was a tortious interference with contract claim. He titled his claims as such. He didn't amend his complaint, even though he filed it four times to assert a prospective economic advantage claim in the alternative. And even though he had seen motions to dismiss filed by the defendants making the arguments that were ultimately accepted by Judge Asman, he did not modify his complaint in any way. In fact, he didn't try to defend his pleadings when we filed a motion to dismiss. He didn't explain his pleadings at that time, again, holding firm to the tortious interference with contract claim, and the judge got it right by dismissing those claims because the contracts on their face say they can be terminated at 30 days' notice by either party. Even if he was to convert the claim to a prospective economic advantage claim, well, let me step back. He doesn't even assert that he's established the elements of that claim in his opening brief on appeal. He simply says, I should be given an opportunity to replead that, or I should have been given an opportunity to replead that. He had plenty of opportunities to plead and replead, but even if the court were to convert to a prospective economic advantage claim, the decision would still hold because there are no allegations here that he had a reasonable expectation that this relationship would continue, that the other side had an expectation it would continue, that he had performed his side of the bargain. And because he's not pled those factors, those allegations, the claim could not succeed. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Peel.
May it please the court once again. With respect to Mr. Peel's comments that this is not an exceptional case, I beg to differ. Admittedly, while there are two parties to this conversation, one of the parties is the defendant tortfeasor in this case, Mr. Harris. The other party is Mr. Del Caliano. Now, counsel suggests that his deposition wasn't taken, his affidavit wasn't proffered. As a practical matter, Judge, Your Honors, we made our investigation. Mr. Del Caliano said, I cannot recall what transpired 2 years ago without the benefit of my notes, and that was set forth in my affidavit, which is part of this record. We attempted to secure those notes. We sent two out-of-state subpoenas. We could not locate the notes. Taking his deposition would have been absolutely futile because his recollection could not be refreshed without his notes. This article is perhaps one of hundreds or thousands of articles that he had written over the course of the year. In fact, the subject article, the January 11, 2002 article, is probably one of several news stories he wrote that day. So we beg to differ with Mr. Peel that this is not an exceptional case warranting the application of the residual exception. Further, in this case, counsel suggests that we are relying upon inadmissible hearsay with respect to several other statements in the record, Ms. Pedraza, Mr. Milhouse, Mr. Scales, all of which are part of this record. In this case, these are statements directly attributable or made by the defendant Harris. This is not inadmissible hearsay. It's a basic proponent or proposition of evidence law. This is a statement by a defendant, a party opponent in this case. These statements are clearly admissible in this case. The letters which counsel talked about, these letters were not simple criticisms of Mr. Cody's performance in the course of his duties. They were scathing, personal attacks upon Mr. Cody.
These are the internal letters?
These are internal letters. Numerous letters which said he was violent, he was mentally unstable, that he was capable of committing corporate sabotage. Again, it goes to not only the defendant Harris's motive and intent, but it shows that the January 11th article was trustworthy.
Those letters weren't published anywhere, were they?
They were not. They were sent to Mr. Crawford. Regarding the per se counts that were dismissed from the third amended complaint, the statements are that Mark Cody was behind this. This goes to his general duties, his performance as a general sales manager. Clearly, these statements are actionable as part of his duties. These statements touch not only upon the commission of the criminal offense, which I mentioned earlier, but also on the third and fourth categories of the per se actionable counts. With respect to the tortious interference claim that was dismissed by the district court, Judge Aspin specifically barred the plaintiff from amending the complaint any further. When I substituted in this case, we filed the third amended complaint, Judge Aspin actually entered an order saying there would be no further amendment of the pleadings. So it's barred from amending that. Unless the panel has any further questions, would respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's orders dismissing the counts from the third amended complaint and granting the defendants their summary judgment. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.